From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a concert featuring music by George Gershwin, Billy Strayhorn, and Buck Clayton, performed by trombonist Dan Barrett and guitarist Howard Alden. Their sound recalls the small jazz groups of the 30s and 40s. Also today, we examine the current controversy at Pantheon Books. The managing editor resigned under pressure, and writers are protesting it as an assault on editorial independence and cultural freedom. Some say this is a case study in what's gone wrong in publishing now that most of the major houses are owned by conglomerates. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz examines Otto Klemperer's approach to opera, and commentator Patricia McLaughlin explains how the Breck girl became the Breck woman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. U.S. officials say they're checking out reports that a plant in Libya they believe is being used to produce chemical weapons is on fire. The officials say the reports about the fire began reaching Washington about midday today. The White House last week accused Libya of making chemical weapons at the plant and did not rule out military action to shut the plant down. West German security sources have apparently told the U.S. that the plant has produced up to 50 metric tons of mustard gas since mid-1989. In East Germany tonight, a leading politician resigned after admitting he worked as an informer for the secret police. The head of a center-right party, Wolfgang Schnorr, announced he's dropping out of East Germany's election campaign. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from West Berlin.
The scandal now surrounding Wolfgang Schnorr comes just 4 days before East Germans go to the polls. Schnorr had been mentioned as a possible prime minister. That was before a West German magazine reported that Schnorr had been an informer for the hated Stasi, the secret police, for 16 years. Schnorr reportedly accepted large sums of money for information on East Germany's church movement and human rights activists. Schnorr heads a party that's part of an alliance tied to West Germany's Christian Democratic Party. The CDU is led by Chancellor Helmut Kohl in West Germany. While the coalition was gaining on its major rival in the election, the scandal is likely to cost votes on Sunday. In West Berlin, this is Deborah Amos.
Soviet parliament members vote for the country's first executive president today. Mikhail Gorbachev is the only candidate, and it is expected that he will be elected to fill the new post. Because of the new position's powers, observers are calling it the super presidency. The government of Margaret Thatcher was defeated in Parliament today for the first time in 4 years. That defeat is considered yet another embarrassment to the Thatcher administration, which has recently been having trouble. More from NPR's Jackie Lydon in London.
At issue was a clause in a bill funding nursing home payments for the elderly. Not in itself a very divisive topic, but the opposition Labour Party was able to woo enough conservative crossover votes. The final vote tally was 256 to 253 to secure higher subsidies for the elderly than the Thatcher government wanted to pay. In the end, even this was overturned on a technicality, but the political damage had been done. The controversial vote took 23 hours in Parliament and produced an uproar observers said was unprecedented, forcing the House Speaker to use a motion of grave disorder to end the session for only the fourth time in Parliament's modern history. The defeat could not have come at a worse time for the Thatcher administration, which is under pressure over a new head tax called the poll tax, and the defection of conservative votes in a parliamentary measure only adds to Thatcher's woes. I'm Jackie Lydon in London.
The U.S. and Romania have signed an $80 million food aid agreement. That pact comes with the understanding that the Romanian government will move toward democracy and establish a free market economy. On Wall Street, prices closed higher. Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 13.5 points. It's NPR. A new federal study says the government is not doing enough to ensure the welfare and development of children in daycare. A 19-member panel of the National Research Council conducted a 2-year study on current child care services at the request of the Human Services Department. The study concludes that, quote, existing child care services in the U.S. are inadequate. The panel says America is behind other industrial nations in responding to the social revolution of recent decades that has reshaped the family. Busloads of angry educators rallied in West Virginia this afternoon to respond to the governor's latest proposal for ending a 5-day teacher strike. Demonstrators are demanding pay raises, more benefits, and better working conditions. Susan Leffler reports from Charleston.
Hundreds of teachers dressed in red to show unity marched on the state capitol today.
I would rather be home with my family. I feel like I've neglected them. but I'm here because education is dying in West Virginia, and I have to do something. I hope everybody feels they have to do something.
Last night, Governor Gaston Caperton made what he called his best and final offer to end a statewide walkout. The proposal called for $3 million for pay hikes, about a tenth of what teachers say they need for a 5% raise. The head of the state's largest teachers association, Kayetta Meadows, said the offer was too little, too late, and teachers say they'll stay off the job indefinitely. For National Public Radio, I'm Susan Leffler in Charleston, West Virginia.
Officials are considering requesting a shuttle rescue mission to salvage a $150 million communications satellite that was stranded in a useless orbit today. The Intelsat 6 was launched by a commercial Titan III rocket at Cape Canaveral this morning. The uninsured satellite was lost for several hours before technicians found it still attached to the rocket's second stage. Engineers then radioed the satellite to separate from its booster. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Howard Alden Dan Barrett Quintet have a couple of albums on Concord Jazz. I heard Alden and Barrett recently play in New York. I thought they sounded great, and I figured you'd like them too, so we've invited them to Fresh Air for a concert. The Alden Barrett Quintet plays material inspired by the small jazz groups of the 30s and 40s, like the John Kirby Band and the Buck Clayton Lester Young small group sessions. In fact, trumpeter Buck Clayton, who is now in his late 70s, has been writing and arranging for Alden and Barrett. While their music may be inspired by the past, it's also rooted in contemporary harmonic and rhythmic innovations. Today's concert features three of the members of the quintet. We have Howard Alden on guitar, Dan Barrett trombone, and Frank Tate on bass. The combination of trombone and guitar is, I think, quite unusual, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. Thank you and welcome.
Well, thank you.
Welcome to Fresh Air. And Howard, do you want to introduce the first number you're going to play?
Certainly. We're going to play one of the jazz evergreens that we never seem to get tired of playing. George Gershwin's Let It Be Good. Thank you.
Sounds great. We're listening to a concert with Howard Alden on guitar, Dan Barrett on trombone, and Frank Tate on bass. I find myself listening to a lot of jazz recordings from the 30s and 40s, and I'm always interested in what sends somebody musically to a period that isn't the period they grew up in. Dan, can I ask you how you started listening to earlier jazz?
Certainly. My father had a few 78s lying around the house, and although he wasn't a jazz fan per se, the 78s he had were jazz items, I think, that he brought back from his troop ship during World War II. And they happened to feature two of my favorite trombonists. I was unfamiliar with the names at the time, but one of the trombonists on one of the records was the great Jack Teagarden from Texas, and the other fellow was J.C. Higginbotham, who worked around New York for many, many years. And I had just started to play the trombone about the same time I discovered those 78s, and they made quite an impression on me. I figured, well, that's the way the horn's supposed to sound.
Howard, tell us your story.
Well, it's very similar, really. Again, my parents, even though they weren't hardcore jazz fans as such, they always had a lot of records lying around, and I think when I was about 5 or 6 years old, actually, I came across some 45 RPM records of Benny Goodman and Count Basie, and I always loved the sound of them and was drawn to them.
When you were starting out playing, did you play with a lot of older musicians?
Yes, I did. I started playing first on guitar, and then I played the tenor banjo for a while when I was about 10, and met a lot of piano players in these little pizza joints and stuff like that around Southern California, and they'd tell me about other musicians too. Like, piano player would say, "Hey, kid, have you ever heard of Teddy Wilson?" I'd say, "Well, yeah, I think so." He says, "Well, here's this record. Take it home and listen to it, or go find some Art Tatum records, etc."
Well, I think you have a Strayhorn piece for us next.
Yeah, yeah. This is one of Strayhorn's earlier pieces and one of his most beautiful, Chelsea Bridge.
And Dan, you're putting a mute into your trombone, I notice.
Yes. You're very observant.
Yeah, hey, what, isn't it incredible?
This will give it that old radio quality.
was just beautiful. Who did the arrangement for that?
Oh, we've just kind of put it together. I guess you'd call it a head arrangement. You know, with the difference between playing with this trio and our regular quintet is because it's only three instruments. So a lot of times we just find our own voices and don't have to have it quite as structured. And once we play a thing a few times, we kind of each find our part and lock it in like that. So it's really a collective effort.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And performing today, we have Dan Barrett on trombone, Howard Alden on guitar, Frank Tate on bass. And I should mention that Alden and Barrett also lead a quintet, and we'll just call it the ABQ. That stands for the Alden Barrett Quintet. They have two records out on Concord Jazz. One is called Swing Street, and the other is a salute to Buck Clayton, the trumpeter who's been doing a lot of arranging for the quintet. So more concert after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We're featuring a concert today on Fresh Air. We have Howard Alden on guitar, Dan Barrett trombone, Frank Tate on bass. And I think we have a duet coming up next with Howard Alden and Dan Barrett. And you can play a piece called Claytonia, which is a Buck Clayton composition that's on your latest record.
That's right.
Which is the salute to Buck Clayton. Buck Clayton is a trumpeter who first became famous for his work with Count Basie. Mm-hmm. And he's been doing some arranging for your quintet. How did you meet up with him and form such a good relationship with him?
Well, I first met Buck when I was playing at the Carlisle Hotel with Joe Bushkin, and Buck came in to see us one night because he used to play with Joe years ago, and I was thrilled just to see him and meet him and say hello to him because he was on most of the records I'd been listening to since I was very young. A couple years later, I ran into him also. He was just listening to another big band in town rehearse, and I found out they spent a lot of time at a friend of his, a house which is just two blocks from my apartment in New York City. So I took to hanging out there some afternoons and talking with him, chatting with him. And one day I just let him know that I had a small group that myself and Dan had, was going to play at Eddie Condon's when we first got together. I said we were playing some little arrangements and stuff. And just as an afterthought, I said, hey, Buck, if you feel like it, why don't you write us something, write something for the group? And he said, well, okay, yeah. Asked what the instruments were. And I expected maybe to see something 6 months down the line or something like that. He called me up 2 days later and said, come on over and pick up. I got two charts for you, original compositions arranged for our group. We rehearsed them, and they sounded great, and we loved them, and he listened to the group rehearse. About a week later, I was walking in my neighborhood to the bank or something and saw Buck on the other side of the street, waved at him. He came over and gave me two more arrangements. And basically, he just comes and listens to the band as much as he can, and he writes incessantly. And we keep encouraging him to keep writing originals like he's been doing.
Why don't you play it for us?
Okay.
Terry, I will say that although we recorded this as a duet on the CD, we're going to ask Frank here to join us in this version today. So it technically won't be a duet all the way through. We'll have Frank Tate join us at some point in the proceedings.
Oh, very well. Thank you.
Wonderful. And that was Claytonia, composed and arranged by Buck Clayton, featuring Dan Barrett on trombone, Howard Alden guitar, Frank Tate on bass. And, gee, I regret that's going to have to wrap up our concert. Time really flew.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, you all sounded great. It was a real pleasure
to
have you here.
Thanks
and I thank you all. And I want to mention your records to our listeners. Howard Alden and Dan Barrett also lead a quintet that has two records on Concord Jazz. The first is called Swing Street, and the new one is called Salute to Buck Clayton. It features all Buck Clayton compositions with one or two exceptions. And they're both on Concord Jazz. And thanks again to all of you for a great concert.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can you play us out?
A little Devil in the Deep Blue Sea, perhaps. One, two, one, two, three.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Is the priority of book publishing to keep alive the free exchange of ideas and opinion, or is it to make a profit? Many say this question is at the heart of the recent controversy surrounding Pantheon Books, whose managing director resigned rather than change the book list. Coming up, we examine the Pantheon controversy and how publishing is changing in the era of conglomerate ownership. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz examines conductor Otto Klemperer's approach to opera. And commentator Patricia McLaughlin explains how the Breck girl became the Breck woman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. There are reports today that a plant in Libya thought to make chemical weapons is on fire. And ABC television quotes Libyan sources who say the plant is burned to the ground. U.S. officials say that they are checking reports about the plant and stories that Libya has closed its borders. Both President Bush and spokesman Marlon Fitzwater have denied any U.S. involvement in the matter. Last week, the White House accused Libya of making chemical weapons at the plant and did not rule out military action against it. In Moscow, Soviet leader Gorbachev has held off an attempt to force him to put his popularity to the test in a direct election for the new post of executive president. Instead, Parliament is deciding the matter in a vote, the results of which will be announced tomorrow morning. Bridget Kendall, the BBC, reports that Gorbachev is now the only candidate for the new post.
In an emotionally charged atmosphere, deputy after deputy told the Congress that their voters had asked for direct elections to test the new president's popularity across the country as a whole. But those who came forward to support Mr. Gorbachev's call for an emergency election straight away were some of the most highly respected members of the parliament, including the veteran historian Dmitry Lihachev. "I'm probably the oldest deputy here, and I remember the February Revolution of 1917," he said, and warned the parliament that unless an executive president was appointed immediately, the country could descend into civil war. The contest Mr. Gorbachev was to face was against his prime minister, Nikolai Ryzhkov, and the interior minister, Vadim Bakhatin, but both refused to stand against him. This now leaves Mr. Gorbachev as a single candidate on the ballot sheet, and so long as he receives 50% of the votes, he is assured of becoming the Soviet Union's first executive president.
Bridget Kendall, the BBC in Moscow. The Bush administration today turned down a call by black South African leader Nelson Mandela for tougher economic sanctions against his country. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more.
Yesterday, Mandela called on Western countries to break off relations with South Africa and to impose tougher sanctions. But today, the State Department's Margaret Tutwiler left little doubt that there would be no change in U.S. policy.
"We believe we can best play a helpful role in support of negotiations by maintaining contact with both sides and by following existing U.S. law with respect to sanctions."
Tutwiler says the administration intends to abide by the 1986 law that requires, among other things, that South Africa release all political prisoners and lift the state of emergency. She said that because South Africa has not taken those steps, the current sanctions will be enforced. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 13 points to close at 2,687.84. On volume of 145 million shares, trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has the second in his two-part profile of the late German conductor Otto Klemperer. Klemperer was one of the last direct disciples of Gustav Mahler, but this week Lloyd plays some other Klemperer recordings of opera and Mozart.
Last week, I played selections from three of the composers most closely associated with Otto Klemperer: Mahler, Beethoven, and Brahms. Klemperer hewed to the German tradition in music. Except for Stravinsky and Berlioz, whom he performed with great beauty and clarity, the few non-German composers Klemperer played, like Franck, Dvorak, and Tchaikovsky, were heavily under the German influence. Trendy early instrument performances have made the earliest composers Klemperer recorded, Bach and Handel, seem old-fashioned in their rich textures, though they remain soul-stirring. Less well-known are Klemperer's recordings of the high classical repertoire. His Haydn and Mozart symphonies are among the most beautiful ever made. I've never heard a G minor symphony more moving than Klemperer's 1957 performance, though some people find his tempos almost perversely slow. He recorded the symphony more than once. I'm glad it's this version Angel chose for its new three-disc Mozart set. One of Klemperer's greatest Mozart performances is not a symphony, but the extraordinarily ambitious Serenade for 13 Winds. Here Mozart transcends the simple music-for-entertainment origin of the Serenade. Klemperer's recording with the London Wind Quintet and Ensemble presents a profound insight into the way Mozart can be simultaneously ravishing and heartbreaking.
Thank you.
Klemperer's earlier Mozart symphonies, the Little G Minor Symphony No. 25 and the Paris No. 31, have the transparency and shapeliness of chamber music. One of the ways Klemperer makes the architecture of a work so vivid is through orchestral balances. When a theme or melody arrives that has important structural significance, Klemperer highlights the instruments that play it. His broad tempos allow him to keep his textures unhomogenized. Even in the thickest ensembles, each musical line seems outlined in air. Klemperer's best-known Mozart album is probably The Magic Flute. He plays down the comic elements and even the all-star cast, but the most serious music, growing out of Mozart's affiliation with the Masons, has seldom sounded more consequential. One of Klemperer's earliest professional experiences was in opera. He actually conducted Caruso in Carmen. He didn't make many opera recordings. His three Mozart Italian operas, Figaro, Don Giovanni, and Così fan tutte, have been attacked for their lack of humor. These have not yet appeared on compact disc. One that has, Klemperer's version of Beethoven's Fidelio, is rightly considered one of the greatest opera recordings ever made. And his Flying Dutchman may be more controversial for the singing than for his exhilarating conception of Wagner's score. Not every Klemperer performance works, but every one is heroic in dimension and noble in impulse. How much smaller most of today's music making seems in comparison.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a series of Otto Klemperer reissues on Angel Records. This is Fresh Air. The big publishing news this month isn't about the release of a new book. It's about the changes going on in the industry itself. To some people, this is a story of fiscal responsibility. But to others, it's a case study in what's gone wrong in the book world now that most of the major publishing houses are owned by conglomerates. The current controversy centers around Pantheon Books. A couple of weeks ago, Pantheon's managing director, Andre Schifrin, resigned. Reportedly, he was forced out after refusing to cut back the book list and to fire staff to save money. When Schifrin left, five of his senior editors resigned in protest. This came just a few months after Robert Bernstein's resignation. Bernstein was the head of Random House, which owns Pantheon. Bernstein was also reportedly forced out for refusing orders from above to make cutbacks at Pantheon. Pantheon is an imprint of Random House Incorporated. Other imprints of Random House include Knopf, Ballantine, Villard, Vintage, Times Books, and Random House. Random House recently acquired Crown Books, and some say it's the expense of this acquisition that's forcing Random House to squeeze the Pantheon budget. Now Random House is bidding on another publishing company, Grove Weidenfeld. Random House is part of a publishing conglomerate owned by S.I. Neuhaus. Several hundred writers have signed a petition protesting the forced resignations at Pantheon, which they describe as an assault on editorial independence and cultural freedom. Todd Gitlin is one of the writers who drafted the petition. He's a Pantheon author and director of the Mass Communications Program at the University of California at Berkeley. I asked him to read an excerpt from the petition.
Although we are not privy to all the interior discussions or motives, what is clear is that the effect of Mr. Schifrin's forced resignation is to chill the intellectual environment. An important part of our national dialogue, the basis of an informed citizenry in a democratic society, has been silenced. In a year when intellectual freedom has scored such stunning successes around the world, it is appalling that a unique center of intellectual vitality should be so thoughtlessly extinguished in America.
What do you see as the importance of Pantheon as a publishing company? Do you see it as being different from most other publishers in any way?
Well, many of the commercial publishers publish very good books and even controversial books, but Pantheon was singular, has been singular, in its commitment to publish books which were matters of intellectual energy, matters of intellectual diversity, books which pushed past the normal commercial as well as political boundaries. It sought out normally unavailable or normally marginal voices, voices from Latin America, voices from Europe, and tried to open up space for a wider sort of general discussion.
Now, the editor, André Schifrin, was forced out for refusing to make cutbacks in Pantheon. Now, what's so unusual about that?
Well, we don't really know exactly what went on. I mean, that's maybe the first thing that should be said. Nobody is really speaking on the record about what exactly he was being told to do. I don't know that there's anything wrong with publishers deciding to cut their list, but to me the issue is that the publisher ought to decide to cut the list. And once a large conglomerate infringes upon the prerogatives of a publisher, and in this case an extremely distinguished and practiced publisher, and dictates the size of the list and how the list ought to be conducted, then you have infringed upon editorial independence and cultural freedom.
In the past, do you think that publishing houses the size of Pantheon were expected to turn big profits? If they lost money, who would carry the losses?
I think there was a time when it was easier for a conglomerate or a large house like Random House to reserve one enclave which was not expected to do quite as well economically. It was, in a sense, a sort of prestige loss leader. Increasingly, though, I get the sense proprietors think every enterprise in their vast empire is expected to deliver X percent a year. It's as if a bookstore was expecting to make a comparable profit from every section. It was going to make as much money from political science as from self-help books. And this is a nightmare for culture. When everything is expected to make the same amount of money, this is a nightmare.
Writer and media critic Todd Gitlin. Earlier today, I spoke with Alberto Vitali, the new CEO at Random House, which owns Pantheon. He denied that managing director André Schifrin was forced out of Pantheon. And when I asked Vitali about plans for Pantheon's future, he said he'll leave that up to the new head of Pantheon. I asked Vitali to respond to the criticism that conglomerate ownership in publishing is emphasizing the bottom line at the expense of literary quality and diversity.
The famous conglomerates that everybody's talking about are obviously the result of certain market conditions which made it necessary to form those conglomerates. You take, for instance, Pantheon. If Pantheon had not been part of Random House, it would have been gone a long time ago because it could not have sustained itself. So my feeling is that that the conglomerates that everybody's talking about, are a good thing for publishing. Now, in my opinion, publishing has never been healthier.
Do you think that there are ways that the publishing industry needs to change in order to stay competitive and to keep up?
Yes. It has to be run more as a business than it has ever been, and that's the trend that has developed since the early 80s. Okay. But that doesn't mean that running a publishing house more as a business interferes with the editorial and publishing independence of the houses that are involved. On the contrary, it becomes better support, and it gives those publishing houses better tools to operate more effectively.
I sense that there's a lot of concern in the publishing world that as publishing houses become more part of larger conglomerates, that it's people with business backgrounds and not book backgrounds who are making a lot of big decisions, and that they're putting the emphasis more on business than on the quality of books. Now, my understanding is that you came into the book world from being an executive at a holding company, and that when that holding company bought Bantam, that was how you entered into publishing.
That is correct.
So I'm wondering, as someone who comes from the business and finance world and is now in the publishing world, what do you think of people in publishing positions whose background isn't in literature but in business? Do you think that's having an unhealthy effect on the industry?
Absolutely not. I would like to remind you that when I got into publishing at Bantam, Bantam was a $70 million company. When I left it to come to Random House, it was a $550 million company. So I don't know if you call that having a bad effect. But to be more specific, when you have businesses, you know, in the range of $500 to $1 billion, you have to run them like businesses. Okay? Creative people are there to create, and business people are there to manage and, you know, to take care of business.
Farrar, Straus & Giroux is one of the few major independent publishers left. I asked Roger Straus why it remains independent.
Well, it gives it, the word independence, you've got exactly the right word. It gives us total independence. Total independence about our overhead, total independence about our editorial policy, total independence upon our personnel, our editors, and our relationship with our authors. That's what independence means to me.
Have you seen that independence compromised at publishing companies that have been taken over by conglomerates?
Constantly. I don't think you could, practically not able to mention a takeover object, publisher, where that compromise in some form or other has not been violated. And I use violated, of course, as a pejorative word. That violation or that control could be merely the firing of a particular editor or publisher. It could be the putting out to pasture of an author. It could be any of the things I mentioned before, individually or collectively. Obviously, the old saw is true. If somebody buys the house, they start moving the furniture.
What are the temptations? What are the gains of being taken over by a larger company?
Well, the gains theoretically are that a larger company can bankroll you better, can give you a better support system, and that support system could be sales, it could be promotion, it could be advertising, it could be just plain money to pay larger advances for books that you might normally not be able to get. Those are the temptations, plus the fact that somebody is probably making money out of it, i.e. whoever sells is probably getting some cash in hand that it didn't have before.
Is it hard to remain an independent publishing house?
It's very hard to remain an independent publishing house, and the main reason for the difficulties in remaining independent is the ability to get absolutely first-rate distribution of your, you should pardon the expression, products, i.e. books. That is the great difficulty. When I was on the board, when I was at the National Endowment of the Arts, my last voice there was when we were giving money away to small publishers that it would be much better over to give a substantial hunk of money to set up a distribution system for smaller publishing houses so that they could become competitive in their distribution to the larger groups. That, I think, is the key to it. And someday that will be achieved. I don't know how it's going to be achieved, but I do know that some of the jobbers are addressing themselves to that. And when that happens, then the possibilities are, of course, difficult, but they're not insurmountable.
Have there been offers ever to buy out your house?
Every day.
And how do you...
twice a day.
Really? How do you turn them down?
Well, fortunately, there is no pressure on me by my stockholders and directors. They like what we're doing, they're happy with the management, and they're happy with the kind of books that we publish. So if, you know, if somebody comes along and say, well, if you're owned by XYZ, your overhead would be down, we could do this, we could do that, we could do that. Everybody yawns slightly.
So you're going to hold out?
Not only are we going to hold out, because what is happening, of course, plays very much into our hands. We have more and more, referrals, as they say in the world of gynecology, than we've ever had before.
In other words, as editors and writers leave some of the more conglomerized houses, you get them?
Yep. I signed a book this morning that I can't tell you the name of, a very important writer, who turned down much more money from one of the good-name conglomerates to come to us.
Publisher Roger Strauss, this is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams in Washington with a word about all things considered. In Moscow, despite warnings from some in the Soviet parliament, President Gorbachev moves into a strengthened position as president. There is intense violence in some of the black townships in South Africa. It's called black-on-black violence. NPR's John Madison describes the practice called jack-rolling and some action taken in revenge there. Much of the violence is said to be resulting from the recent renewal of strength and hope in the anti-apartheid movement. A report from West Germany on the unification talks, and we'll meet a fictional Chicago insurance detective named V.I. Warshawski. She is the subject of a series of detective stories written by Sarah Paretsky. That's coming up and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Remember those magazine ads for Breck shampoo? The dreamy illustrations of girls with lustrous hair? Breck girls. The four finalists for the Breck Woman of 1990 contest have been chosen, and early next month, the winner will be announced on Joan London's TV show Every Day. Patricia McLaughlin reflects on how the notion of beauty has changed in the 54 years since the first Breck girl appeared.
When I was 15, I would have given anything to look like the Breck girl. She was all over the place then, on the back covers of half the magazines published in America. She was perfect. Perfect skin, perfect features, and especially perfect hair. It was usually long and always shiny and absolutely manageable, so obedient that you could still see where the teeth of the comb had passed through it. My hair looked like Brillo then. "Go brush your hair," my mother used to tell me. "You look like the wild woman of Borneo." Somewhere in high school, I finally figured out how to smooth it out with gargantuan rollers. On rainy days, it would have turned back into Brillo by the time I got to school. You could tell this never happened to the Breck girl. You could tell nothing bad happened to her. Nobody nagged her to clean her room or wash the dinner dishes. No little sisters absconded with her last decent pair of knee socks 10 minutes before she had to leave for school. She looked like she'd never had an argument in her life. This was a tribute not so much to the sweet-temperedness of the gorgeous women who posed for those covers. Famous models like Kim Basinger, Sybil Shepherd, Cheryl Teagues, and Brooke Shields, but to an illustrator with the unlikely name of Ralph William Williams. He did their portraits in soft pastels, perfecting each one of them in the process and turning her into the Breck girl, a type as recognizable and as right for its time as the Gibson girl was for hers. Sweet, daydreamy, as well-behaved as her hair. This was probably what finished the Breck girl finally. By the early 70s, that kind of bland perfection seemed irrelevant. I hardly noticed when she disappeared from the magazine covers in 1978. But what goes around comes around. Breck revived her a couple of years ago, and of course they quickly updated her into the Breck woman. Now she's more than just a pretty head of hair. The 1989 Breck woman, Pam Chu, teaches French and Italian at the University of Tulsa. She has a husband and a 2-year-old daughter to keep up with. She teaches English to refugees in her spare time. She seems like a neat person. I talked to her on the phone yesterday, like somebody you'd like to live next door to or be friends with. She's even a big fan of fresh air. She's half Chinese, so she remembers the Breck girl on those old magazine covers as somebody she could never look like either.
I have very straight, thick, dark hair, and my skin is olive. And, of course, I have very dark eyes, no more blue. And my, well, just being the mix that I am. I don't have that all-American look.
You'd think I'd feel vindicated to have the Breck woman turn out to be somebody pretty much like me. A normal person with non-Breck girl hair. And I do. But I can't help feeling bad for the frizzy-haired teenager I was. Because then, I really believed those ads. I believed that if I had beautiful hair like the Breck girl, my life would be perfect. And I tried to have that kind of hair. And I suffered for not having it. And now, 30 years later, just like that, they change their minds. They come out and say, oh, go ahead, have any kind of hair you want. I quit believing in Breck girl hair a long time ago myself, but somehow I still feel betrayed.
Patricia McLaughlin is a syndicated columnist who writes about style for the Philadelphia Inquirer magazine. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Sue Spolin and Lugene DeJoseph. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with singer, songwriter, and record producer Nick Lowe. He was one of the forces behind England's pub rock and new wave movements of the 70s. Also, we meet comic book artist Kim Deitch. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.